Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is Monday, February 23rd, 2026. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary. She makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Tilton, Senator Stevens, my vice chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. The first item on our agenda is a continuation of our presentation from February 11th. On February 11th, we've nearly finished a presentation on the Alaska Criminal Justice Data Analysis Commission's 2025 annual report. Here to finish that presentation is Suzanne DiPietro, Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. Today she is with us online, not in person, but Ms. DiPietro, if you would please put yourself on the record, you may begin your presentation. And I know what
thank
we're
you,
doing.
Chair.
Is, oh, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Klayman. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. My name is Suzanne DiPietro. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. The Alaska Judicial Council, by statute, staffs the work of the Criminal Justice Data Analysis Commission. And I think the last, where we ended last time, I can't see exactly what slide you're on up there in the room, but I think we were sort of talking about recidivism, which I think is my slide 16. Does that work for the committee?
That tracks my memory. Does anybody have a different memory about where we were? Let's go there.
All right, to the chair, then I'll continue. So we were just talking about recidivism. Recidivism is one of the items that the Criminal Justice Data Analysis Commission is required to analyze for the criminal justice system. And there's a lot of recidivism is a complicated concept. As a broad proposition, it is a way of thinking about outcomes in the criminal justice system, having to do with whether people who have been through the system in some way come back, or whether they refrain from activities that would bring them back into the criminal justice system. So one of the first things to understand about recidivism is that we can only measure the data that we have. So when we say that a person went through the criminal justice system and then did not recidivate, in other words, what we mean is that we don't have records of that person coming back through the system. It does not necessarily mean that the person was refraining from criminal behavior. And that is because we can only measure what we can count, and not all criminal behavior comes to the attention of law enforcement, which we sort of talked about when I started this presentation, when we were looking at crime reported to law enforcement. So that's not all the crime necessarily that happens. It's just the crime that's reported to law enforcement. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the measure of how often or whether people come back through the system can be thought of in various ways. There are a number of different dimensions. So one of the dimensions is how do they come back into contact with the criminal justice system? Are they rearrested? Are they reincarcerated? Are they reconvicted of a crime? And those are all important measures. But you could see that a person who came back because they were rearrested might not be in the same category, might not be counted in the category of people who came back after a reconviction. Why is that? Well, we just had some graphs and charts previously showing that a significant percentage of cases that are filed in the criminal justice system are dismissed with no conviction. So a case that's dismissed as no conviction, that person would not be counted as someone who recidivated based on reconviction. Now, they may have been rearrested, in which case we would count them as being rearrested. So you can see it can get pretty murky pretty quickly. And I guess I'll just apologize right now for the lack of my ability anyways to draw a pretty black and white line around this conversation, but I would certainly appreciate any questions from the committee about particular aspects of this that you might be interested in. Otherwise, I'll sort of just plow ahead for the way I understand it.
I see no questions. Keep going.
All right. So the definition that the commission uses, which is in the statute, is we're looking at previously convicted individuals. So that's an important first concept, is that we're not looking at previously arrested individuals. We're not looking at individuals who've previously committed a crime or engaged in criminal behavior. We're starting with a group of people who have been convicted. Then we follow those people for 3 years following the date of conviction, or if they went to prison, we follow them from when they got out of prison, the date they got out of prison, for 3 years. And then we look at what happened to them. And we look and see whether they were booked or otherwise returned to a correctional facility. So again, circling back to what I just kind of ramblingly tried to explain, a person might be booked into a correctional facility, but might not ever have subsequent charges or a conviction. So it's important to sort of keep that, keep those guardrails in mind. The other thing that I wanted to say is, this is kind of something to think about. So we all, I think, intuitively understand that, people have some degree of control over their own lives. They make decisions about how they want to move forward with their lives, especially after having been through the criminal justice system. But there's also a dynamic of how the system is responding to the individual. So, for example, let's just say that you had an individual who came out of a correctional facility, or they've been convicted of a crime, and we started following them for their 3-year period, but they happen to live in a community where there was no law enforcement. Maybe they're never rearrested. Maybe they're never reconvicted, but that doesn't mean that they weren't engaging in criminal behavior. So what I'm trying to say is that the activities of the system affect the recidivism rate. I'm not denying that the activities of the individual will affect their recidivism rate, but I think, just as a researcher, it's important to remember that the system has the players in the criminal justice system rightfully have their own operational constraints, priorities, and abilities to engage in certain behaviors, and that really can have a systemic effect on recidivism. And another example might be the thing I was referring to earlier about prosecution policies, that it may be that a person gets charged, but the case is dismissed at the discretion of the prosecutor for some good reason that the prosecutor has, and then that person's not going to be reconvicted, and that's going to affect the recidivism rate. Even though we might look at that, and we might say, "Well, wait a minute, is that right?" You know, and it's just important to keep in mind that there are a lot of variables at play, and they interact with one another in ways that are pretty, I think, complicated and not necessarily easy, at least for me to explain or understand. Anyway, so having given you all those caveats, we could go to the next slide. I guess it's 17. I'm sorry that I didn't put numbers on these. And these are just the recidivism rates of these cohorts that I was talking about. So we get a bunch of people and we follow them for 3 years. And we measure whether they came back into a correctional facility during that 3-year period. And as we were just discussing yesterday, or last week at the end of the hearing, there's a very steep curve there at the beginning when people are trying to get their feet underneath them coming out of that correctional facility usually. Although, so they're trying to get their feet underneath them. And that is a timeline of high rates of failure. All right. So if there's no questions on that, I think I'll just go into the – oh, sure.
Just one question. It appears from the graph that looking 2016 and 2018 are fairly close lines together. But when you look at the 2022 graph, which is the most recent data, there is a reduction compared to prior years.
Mm-hmm. It does appear that way. And I've got a couple of things to say about that. It could well be that that is an accurate reflection of what we see. But one thing to know is that those people are pandemic people. So if we were following them for 3 years, right around 2022, we're getting some pandemic interference. And as you all, I think, know, the system was really operating in different ways than it historically had during the pandemic. And also our cohorts got much smaller, have gotten much smaller recently. So that's a trend that we need to keep our eye on. That might be a good trend that we see accelerating, and that would be great.
And I think Senator Akil has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just maybe a couple. Ms. DiPietro, does this chart include both felonies and misdemeanors as the most serious charge?
Yes, it does. Through the chair to Senator Akil, yes, this does include misdemeanors and felons.
A follow-up, if I may.
Senator Akil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, if we were to split those out, would we see any material difference in these time series and their recidivism rates?
Do you mean between misdemeanors and felonies?
Yes.
Through the chair to Senator Akil, I don't know that we would see a difference in the shape of the arcs. I think whether you're a misdemeanor or a felon, those first days are higher risk days for failure. I might need to follow up with you on the details. We might see some differences, and I certainly know that historically there have been differences between, for example, misdemeanor property offenders versus other types of offenders, but I don't want to speak to it right now. I could follow up with some data if you'd like to have that breakdown.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. Please proceed.
All right. So then last week, Senator Tobin asked about probation and parole. And that's a part of the annual report that I added to these slides at her request. And so I'm just going to do it's not my area of expertise, probation and parole, but I can hopefully do it a broad overview. So I'm going to give you the definitions of probation and parole, and then I'll show you information we have about discretionary parole, which is within the authority of the parole board. So probation is a condition that is ordered by a judge at the time of judgment or sentencing, and judges put people on probation with conditions usually, and those conditions would be such as, for example, if the person was convicted of DUI, that one condition might be not to consume alcohol, not to consume drugs. If the person were convicted of a domestic violence crime, a condition of probation might be not to contact the victim or to take enroll in a domestic violence batter intervention program. So those are the types of conditions that judges order. Probation is ordered when a judge suspends any portion of a term of active imprisonment. So the idea is that the judge suspends some of the time of active imprisonment, and if the person is unable to comply with the conditions of probation, they could be remanded to a correctional facility to serve that some or all of that additional suspended time. Felony probationers are supervised by probation officers at the Department of Corrections. Misdemeanor probationers generally do not receive active supervision. They're said to be on open courts probation or supervision. So parole is the release of an individual from incarceration before their completion of a sentence of active imprisonment. And I wrote there are three kinds, but totally miscounted. There are four kinds of parole in the statute. This is all statutory. Mandatory parole, discretionary parole, geriatric, and special medical. I'm not going to talk too much about geriatric or special medical parole because actually the last time we checked in with the Department of Corrections, we revised that they currently in 2025 had in December of 2025, they did not have anyone. They were not supervising anyone on geriatric or special medical parole. Mandatory parole is when a person is serving, they have to be serving at least a 2-year term of incarceration, and that they get credit for good time. And then many people, not everyone, would then be released on mandatory parole. In other words, they would have the right to be released before the active term in prison is over, as long as they've got that good time credit. Discretionary parole is a little bit different. So it applies just to people who are sentenced to at least 181 days. They have to have served a certain portion of their sentence before they're eligible for discretionary parole, and that's controlled by statute. And they have to make an application to the parole board, and then the parole board determines whether to grant their request for discretionary parole. And parolees are also supervised by probation and parole officers at the Department of Corrections. Felony, I should say. So the data, moving to the next slide, the data that we have showed about 3,200 people who are on supervised probation and parole in Alaska. I've mentioned before that geriatric and special medical parole are not that common. And as between discretionary and mandatory parole, the majority of parolees are released on mandatory parole. And we have some figures here for 2024. So there were 714 people released to parole in 2024. 655 were on mandatory parole and 59 were on discretionary parole.
Senator Stevens has a question.
Yeah, I just wonder if you can help us out on this geriatric and special medical. I think I heard you say that that's something that's not used anymore. Is that something that has been used in the past? Did you take more advantage of letting folks out who have special medical needs or geriatric needs? Do you understand the question? Yeah.
Through the chair to Senator Stevens, I would have to check in with the Board of Parole about that. I'm not sure how actively it was used in the past. I'll have to check back. I'll have to check in with them and get back to you if that's okay.
Well, thank you. It'd be interesting to know that because we're facing extreme costs in our those folks who are imprisoned. And if geriatric and special medical was used more in the past, it'd be nice to know that.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Stevens, my memory is that we added geriatric and special medical parole in recent years. And so, and Ms. DiPietro can correct me if I'm wrong, but my memory is that we did not, 20 years ago, we didn't have either of them, and that these were brought in more recent years being during the time I've been in the legislature, but I can't tell you when, that we brought them in. And And I do think that since we brought them in, they've had very little use.
Okay. Thank you.
To the chair, that's my understanding as well. And I should just say, just because there weren't any individuals on this particular day being actively supervised doesn't mean that no one had been released on those types of parole. They just, you know, we were just checking in on that one day, getting that data. So that's information that we have to get through the parole board. All right.
Please proceed.
So then my next slide is just, this shows over time by calendar quarter, the number of discretionary parole hearings held before the parole board, and of those hearings, the number of times discretionary parole was granted. And this is from information from the parole board. So you can see there's a big spike there. And let me just get my notes here so I'm sure to get this correct. So there were changes to the law in 2017. So before 2017, a person wishing to be considered for discretionary parole was required to file an application with the parole board. Then starting in 2017, the legislature changed the law to require hearings for all those who were eligible, whether or not they requested it. And it also expanded the number of people eligible. So you can see there, starting in 2017, that big spike in the number of hearings, right? Because the people who did not have to go to the trouble to file an application for discretionary parole, they were just scheduled for a hearing. You can see also a little bit that the number of people granted discretionary parole did go up a little bit there too, although not as far up as the number of hearings did. Then in 2019, the law reverted to requiring an application in order to be considered for discretionary parole. It also limited eligibility for some crimes, and you can see the results of that as the number of hearings goes down and the number of grants also goes down. So that's all I had on probation and parole, unless there are any questions.
If you could go back to the slide, the graph. If my memory is accurate, the increase in parole hearing numbers coincided with passage of the Justice Reform Bill, Senate Bill 91, and the decline coincided with the rollback of many provisions in the Justice Reform Bill, and that would have occurred in early 2019 or would have taken effect essentially in halfway through the year in 2019.
Yeah, to the chair, that's exactly right.
Senator Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. So, Ms. DiPietro, if I'm reading the slide right, the difference in the number of discretionary paroles granted compared to, I guess I don't have a baseline before the enactment that the chair referred to, but certainly afterwards, is something like 50 or 70 discretionary paroles per quarter, so 200 to 280 a year. Is that, am I understanding that right?
This is by calendar quarter. So I'd have to double check that, but I think that's probably about right. Yeah. Okay. Through the chair.
So then the follow up there is, I tried to flip back and forth between that and your slide number 9, your criminal case filings, and just figure out if there's any relationship between a lot more folks getting out on discretionary parole and criminal cases we've had to file. And I guess I don't have sophisticated statistical tools. I'm eyeballing it. Can you find a relationship in the numbers? I'm not sure I see one.
Through the chair to Senator Keel, that wouldn't be something that I would notice a pattern. No, if they don't seem to be related to me.
Yeah. Thank you.
I don't see any other questions from members of the committee. Thank you very much for joining us again today and getting us more information on the committee report. I would note that if folks have follow-up questions about what's in the report, Ms. DiPietro and the Judicial Council are very available to answer those questions, specific questions about the report. And as chair of that commission, my office also has a reasonable amount of knowledge about what's in the report as well. We're going to take a very brief at ease to set up for the next presentation. The second last item on our agenda is Senate Bill 251, Repeal Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, sponsored by Senator Wilikowski. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Senator Wilikowski and his staff, David Dunsmore. Thank you for coming forward. Please put yourselves on the record, and you may begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator for East Anchorage, and with me is David Dunsmore in my office. This bill is a bill that you are familiar with, and many in the building are familiar with. It would eliminate the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. The Appeals Commission was set up, I believe, in 2005. For decades before that, the Alaska Superior Court would handle appeals from the Workers' Compensation Board from decisions that they issued. Decision was made. It was a controversial decision to have this commission created. In the last 4 years, this commission in 2022 published five decisions in 2022, two of which were appealed to the Supreme Court, five decisions in 2023, three of which were appealed to the Supreme Court, four decisions in 2024, one of which was appealed, and then last year, three decisions, all of which were appealed to the Supreme Court. What was stated when this commission was initially created was that it would save money and time. It has done neither. It has cost the state money. It's not a lot of money, but it's $518,000 is at least projected this year. One of the arguments was that they would have more expertise and that less cases would be appealed. That has proven not to be the case, as since 2011, 54% of all the cases decisions have issued by the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission have been appealed. The speculation at the time was that this commission would create a group of experts who were very familiar with workers' compensation law, and yet 54% of the cases have been appealed, and a large percentage have been overruled by the Supreme Court. And as you know, Mr. Chairman, Supreme Court appeals can take years to delay. So the notion that this was going to save time, this has actually caused many of these resolutions to be delayed by a number of years. The pressing challenge now, though, is a fiscal one. Whereas in the past we may have been able to afford to have this commission, we just simply do not have that luxury. We have a $2 billion deficit, as you know. Concerning, though, is that this year there is a significant deficit within the workers' compensation, the funds that fund the workers' compensation board, their hearing officers. They have a tremendous shortfall in the number of hearing officers that they have. They have over $1 million deficit that is projected. This will help to close that deficit. This will help to, quite frankly, save either the general fund or or employers from having to see an increase in their costs. And we just can't afford a cost of several hundred thousand dollars per decision that is currently being issued. This bill has passed the House in years past unanimously. It is I don't think a very controversial bill. I'm sure you'll hear some people say they don't like it because, well, they just are used to it and they don't want change. But it's time that we make this change. We need to make some tough decisions with our fiscal situation, and we can no longer afford to have this commission. And I've got David Dunsmore here with a very brief presentation to outline some more of the challenges and concerns that we have with this commission and why it should be repealed. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm David Dunsmore, staff to Senator Willikowski. As the senator said, this bill repeals the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission and returns jurisdiction over workers' compensation appeals to the Superior Court. This will save over $500 million a year and help make our workers' compensation system more solvent. This chart just visualizes the process by which workers' compensation cases are adjudicated currently and under this bill. When a worker files a claim, if it's contested, it gets adjudicated by a hearing panel of the Workers' Compensation Board, which will consist of a hearing officer who's a full-time state employee, and one panel member representing labor and one panel member representing management. Currently, if that agency decision is appealed, those are heard by the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, which is structured similarly to the board. And so that hearing panel will consist of the chair of the commission, who is an attorney and a full-time state employee, and one commissioner from labor and one commissioner from management. This is a unique setup where an agency decision is appealed to another executive branch agency rather than to the Superior Court, and this bill would return jurisdiction over those appeals to the Superior Court. And then Superior Court decisions can be appealed to the Supreme Court, just like currently Appeals Commission decisions can be appealed to the Supreme Court. This bill will save $518,300. Currently, the commission has two full-time employees, as well as covering travel and per diem for commissioners. And the court system has provided a zero fiscal note. And I'll note that the court system has been quite conservative when they prepared fiscal notes for this proposal and basing their estimate on the average cases throughout history, which I believe they based their zero fiscal note on assuming 32 new cases. The actual number of new cases the commission heard last year was 8. So that gives us pretty good confidence that the zero fiscal note is warranted. As you can see, the workload of the commission has fallen dramatically from a high of 49 new cases and 42 published decisions in 2007 to only 8 cases and 3 decisions last year. And I apologize, Mr. Chair, I note a typo. It should say 2025 at the bottom of that slide. This issue has been reviewed by the legislature in the past. In fact, in 2015, the House Labor and Workforce Development Finance Subcommittee evaluated this commission and found it to be an ineffective division. And this was when they were closing 30 cases per year instead of 3 as last year. And as the senator discussed, the Workers' Compensation Commission has not closed cases faster than the courts. The testimony the legislature heard when creating the commission in 2005 was it took 8 to 18 months to decide appeals at the Superior Court, and the goal in creating the commission was for it to take 6 months. By 2018, it was averaging over a year to for the appeals commission to reach decisions. It had decreased as the workload went down to about 9 months, but that's still within the 8 to 18 month range. And significantly more commission decisions are appealed to the Supreme Court, which adds months to potentially years to getting a final resolution in the cases. We expect this bill will reduce appeals to the Supreme Court. When the legislature was considering creating the commission in 2005, the court system testified that 25% of workers' compensations at the Superior Court were appealed to the Supreme Court. Since the commission was created, 37% of their decisions have been appealed, but in recent years, it's been significantly higher. With since 2011, 54% have been appealed. And this makes sense since, you know, we often hear from constituents who just want their day in court. Under the current system, they have an extra layer of bureaucracy before they can get their day in court. Under this, they would be able to get their day in court at the Superior Court level instead of having to wait to the Supreme Court level. There is a growing budget deficit for the workers' compensation program. Workers' compensation is funded through taxes on workers' compensation insurance premiums, as well as fees on self-insurers, and that revenue has been increasingly not able to meet the costs of the program. So in summary, this bill saves about $500,000 a year, reserves parties' rights to have their cases heard in a timely manner, will likely reduce appeals to the Supreme Court, and will make the workers' compensation system more solvent. With that, we'd be happy to answer any questions, or I could walk the committee through a sectional analysis if that's desired.
Senator Keel.
I do have one, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dunsmore, I thought I heard you say at one point that there's no place else that an agency's decision is appealed within the executive branch, but I think that's what the Office of Administrative Hearings is for. Can you talk about why or to the sponsor, whoever prefers, why the decision in this bill is to go directly to the Superior Court rather than to route these through OAH?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So a distinction is, generally speaking, the Office of Administrative Hearings is a state agency that other state agencies may contract with to hold adjudicatory hearings in matters. So OAH decisions are administrative decisions that then themselves can be appealed to the Superior Court. So that's distinct from the setup of the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, where it is a quasi-judicial appointed body within the executive branch that is hearing those administrative appeals that would ordinarily be heard within the Superior Court. Thanks.
Is this bill, there have been other versions of this before the bodies before. Is this significantly different than the last time we saw this bill, either in the House or the Senate? And I can't remember whether I was in the House or the Senate at the time. So,
Mr. Chairman, the only difference between this version and the version that this committee had passed out 2 years ago is the effective dates and all of and the transitional dates are moved forward by 2 years, but the substance is the same.
I don't see any other questions because I think that's a familiar bill. Unless a committee member wants to hear a sectional analysis, I think we have that in the file, so I don't think we need to hear it. I don't see any questions. I would just make my one comment. I believe I've supported this in the past, but many years ago we created an intermediate appeals court for criminal matters, and if we look at the data about how many cases the Alaska Court of Appeals hears in terms of taking on cases that then don't go to the Supreme Court, the vast majority, you can see it's a very efficient use of that intermediate court, and the case numbers here create a pretty challenging case for why are we having this much money spent that they basically decide 4 to 10 cases a year. That's a pretty low caseload in the scheme of things, even for complex cases. But I see no other comments from folks in the committee and no other questions. So we are going to open public testimony on Senate Bill 251. If you're first, is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony on Senate Bill 251? Hearing and seeing no one, I'm going to turn to my screen isn't showing anymore. There we go. It looks like we have one person online for public testimony, Jeffrey Holloway. Mr. Holloway, if you would go ahead with your public testimony. Please, if you're on a speakerphone, turn off the speakerphone because you're not as clear, and we limit public testimony to 2 minutes. Mr. Holloway.
Yes, thank you. My name is Jeffrey Holloway. I've been a workers' compensation attorney practicing in Alaska for 26 years, and I'd like to comment upon Senate Bill 251. I support the bill's passage in this case. I have been practicing long enough to remember back to the time when we used to appeal board decisions directly to the Superior Court and when there was no appeals commission. And there was nothing wrong with that process. That process was fine. Usually a person, either party, if they were unhappy with that decision, would appeal it to the Alaska Supreme Court anyway. And I find that that is still the case when someone is not satisfied with the appeals commission's decisions. I also think that the resources that are allocated to the appeals commission can be better used at the actual board level. As Senator Wilikowski mentioned in his presentation, the board is underfunded, and there's a lack of hearing officers at the board in a sufficient number to move cases towards a final decision in an administrative hearing. Also, unlike in 2005 when the appeals commission was created, parties now in workers' compensation far more often engage in alternative dispute resolution in the form of mediations to resolve the case. And the workers' compensation board hearing officers often act as mediators to attempt to resolve the claims before they actually proceed to a board hearing. I think allocating more resources to that effort will actually be a better use of the state's income and will result in less cases being appealed overall because they will be resolved before proceeding to an administrative hearing through the use of the mediation and alternative dispute resolution process. Although the people at the Appeals Commission are all nice people, I don't think that the state's resources are spent wisely on them. So few cases go before the Appeals Commission, and it's just not a good use of the state's limited resources. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't have anyone else online to provide public testimony, and I see no one else in the room, so I'm going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 251. Last chance for questions from the committee or comments. Seeing nothing else, we're going to set the bill aside unless Senator Wilkowski, anything in closing. Seeing nothing, we will now adjourn for the day. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday, February 25th at 1:30 p.m. We will be having a first hearing on Senate Bill 207, Property Possession and Property Crimes, sponsored by Senator Bjorkman, and a second hearing on House Bill 101, Crimes Against Minors, Age of Consent to 18, sponsored by Representative Gray. The hearings on House Bill 101 on Wednesday will be limited to review of the fiscal notes from both last year and this year. And with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:10 p.m.